They say those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it. And the more cynical of us can be heard to say those who do know their history are doomed to stand by and watch others repeat it. And that brings me to the case of the Channeled Scablands and the Spokane Flood. Now, there was a time when the Channeled Scablands were not thought to be the product of a flood, but now they are most certainly agreed to be the product of flooding, whether you're Graham Hancock, Randall Carlson, or a mainstream geologist. Now, there is a little bit of debate around this. Now, mainstream geology has a hypothesis that's pretty robust. Glacial Lake Missoula filled with water multiple times, ice dam broke, flooded through there, carving this massive Channeled Scablands over a few thousand years, and potentially as many as 100 floods. There's another hypothesis, the Younger Dryas Impact Hypothesis, and this one claims that a comet struck the northern ice sheets about 12,000 years ago. This created a massive flood that carved that pretty much all in one go. Now, it may have already been flooded to some degree before that, but the comet really did the major work then. Now, that latter hypothesis is subject to a lot of scrutiny by a lot of different fields, but most importantly, archaeologists and anthropologists are the ones that seem to have a problem with it. And that's kind of funny because it's a geological hypothesis. It's in the geology wheelhouse. It's challenging the geological hypothesis. Why are all these archaeologists in there so robustly determined to debunk it? Well, it's, in my opinion, it might have something to do with the fact that geology learned a strong lesson from the case of the Channeled Scablands itself. It turned geology on its ear and forced them to re-examine themselves. Now, archaeology has had this chance in recent years with the Clovis First debacle, but it chose not to turn inward, chose not to do any introspection, and it still acts like it did before that. So let's discuss the Spokane Flood. J. Harlan Brett's scientific dogma, archaeology, and just Spokane in general, I guess. Hi, my name's Dan, and welcome to the Dunking. J. Harlan Bretz was a geologist in the early 20th century, and he was pretty obsessed with glaciers and their effects on the landscape. And this brought him to Washington State because it was already well known that the topography here had been heavily affected by glaciers. And since Bretz was obsessed with that sort of thing, people told him, hey man, you should probably come up there and check it out. So he got a teaching job in Washington, a couple different teaching jobs, and ended up mapping a huge chunk of the Channeled Scablands, which brought him to the conclusion that it was created by a flood that he deemed the Spokane Flood. Now, he was not the first person to decide or to posit that a flood created those areas. Arguably, there was two people before him that were both teachers, one in Spokane, Washington, and one over at the University of Washington, and over in Seattle. And both of these guys apparently are recorded as having seen something about some big flood in the area, and Bretz was in contact with both of them, so it's quite possible, even probable, that he gleaned a little info from them and didn't bother crediting them down the road, which would be the first time that sort of thing has happened. But at any rate, that big thing to keep in mind for me is that he really trekked through a lot of land that was inaccessible. There were no highways there. There was no farmland there for the most part. It was just the Scablands. That's a fucking desert. So he would drive somebody else's car out there and hike for 2 to 3 days at a time. And it's some really great stories. If you're into the local history, reading his stuff is really great. Even if for the scrap the geology, he talks about meeting old farmhands and coming across homesteads that fail and just all kinds of cool stuff. But at any rate, he was going places that almost nobody else was going and had gone for a very long time, and mapping it and doing a really good job of it. And this really, like, he was looking at it going, there was no way that this had been created by slow, gradual erosion like the Grand Canyon. And this is important to keep in mind because gradualism versus catastrophism was a very big thing in geology and all the earth sciences at the time. But geology was really, it had erosion. Since like the late 1700s, I think, they were kind of on board, even before evolution, if I remember right, they were on board with the whole idea of gradualism being more important than catastrophism. Gradualism is the belief that slow, steady forces over time change the world into what we live in now. And the catastrophic version of events is amazing floods, comets, fires, and other associated disasters change the world into what it is. And catastrophism was, you know, usually associated with biblical stuff, and gradualism after the 1800s was associated with more scientific stuff. But After a while, they figured out that both could be a thing, and they came up with what an evolution they call what punctuated equilibrium, which is basically slow, gradual things, and then like massive, abrupt changes. Basically the idea that you can have slow, steady erosion and a major flood both eat away at the side of a riverbank. Crazy concept that I'm glad it took science a couple hundred years to figure that one out. Dr. Nick Zenter, a geologist here in Washington State, teaches at Central Washington University and has a YouTube channel that I watch way more than a guy who makes videos about archaeology and the like should. But at any rate, I love the guy's stuff. At any rate, he's talked a ton about J. Harlan Bretz. He's done a lot of work. He's the one, I'm pretty sure he's the man responsible for getting his letters archived where you could go look at them and stuff. He has spoken to J. Harlan Bretz's son. There's an interview that Dr. Zenter has got up there. Again, I've watched this stuff way more than I should have. But he's never met J. Harlan Bretz. In his first video talking about him, he says, like, I didn't really like him because the guy's a little bit more inflammatory than I'm into. But check out what he has to say about the guy.
Who was this guy? Why did he show up in Eastern Washington when he did? It was 100 years ago, by the way, when he first showed up. In the 1920s, he showed up in Eastern Washington. And why was he able to see this amazing stuff and piece this story together when nobody else could do that? What was so unique about this person?
Now, Dr. Zentner has a lot of videos about J. Harlan Bretz, and I'll put a link to it down below to his channel. You should definitely go check it out if you're interested in the story. But the main takeaway is Bretz was fundamentally right. The channeled scablands were created by flooding on a scale that was unimaginable to science at the time. But he was considered wrong, ostracized, may not have even had much of a career if he wasn't so good at illustrations pertaining to geology. Basically, this almost ruined him. He was considered a laughingstock. Entire conferences were organized to kick his hypothesis out of the hallowed halls of academia.
He described this in a paper I'll show a little bit later. He said, over the 9 years where he started publishing papers on the scablands, which began 100 years ago, first papers, 1923. This is the 100-year anniversary of Bretz's putting in the scientific print the outrageous geological hypothesis for the origin of the channel scabland. So here's how he describes it. Many voices were raised in expostulation. He loved to throw those words out there. The general tenor was this heresy must be gently but firmly stamped up. You know, scientists try to be very polite, we're gentle, but you're completely crazy.
And he was right. After decades and decades of debate, he was proven to be right. And for those of you who watch my channel frequently, maybe it's your first time here, but you're into that whole alternate archaeology and pseudo-archaeology and all that stuff. Well, you probably heard of the whole Clovis First debacle that archaeology contended with a few decades ago, but I'll go ahead and lay it out for you really quickly if you hadn't. Basically, the Clovis First hypothesis pertains to the peopling of the Americas. About 13,000 years ago, they say that there was a ice bridge, land bridge, and people came over through Siberia across this Bering land bridge between these two ice sheets, and they ended up in North America, and they brought with them Clovis technology or created it about the time they got here, and, well, eventually they got all wiped out, but those were the first people here, and anything but deemed prior to that, any idea of humans being in the Americas before that was considered absolute horseshit. It was not something that was a possibility to be entertained by archaeologists. Now, of course, 30 years after this stuff was put to bed, 25 years or so later, we can look back on it and say, oh, it was a scientific debate, which is what many archaeologists will do. But the fact of the matter is, it wasn't just a scientific debate. It was, they called them the Clovis Mafia or the Clovis Police. Other archaeologists did, okay? Not me. Other archaeologists said they were being unfair. They were unreasonably disregarding the evidence. Tom Dillahaye really lays it out very well when he talks about how these guys just, they were very unscientific in the way that they handled this. And at times, even crossing the lines into like threats against a person and calling people's employers and all kinds of nasty stuff that shouldn't really be done. And this was all done because they were arguing about arrowheads. They were arguing about who came across the land bridge first. So This is where you'll find a lot of a, there's a good comparison here between the situation with the Clovis first hypothesis and the situation with the idea of this being a flood that created the Channel Scablands. It was very difficult to overturn Clovis first. It was very difficult to prove that this flood happened, even though the evidence was overwhelming for decades. Now, earlier in the video, I said that archaeology isn't learning from its mistakes like geology is, and this is what I mean. Archaeology hasn't really learned from Clovis first. It still fights tooth and nail against anything that comes in and fights the existing paradigm. But when it comes to geology, they do things quite a bit differently than they used to. As a matter of fact, I'll let Dr. Vic Baker explain.
M. King Hubbard took J. Harlan Bretson's field course. And he had three principles that he later used for his entire career. He learned them from J. Harlan Bretz in the field because the technique shocked him. I mean, he was the kind of guy that devoured information, was exceedingly well prepared. So he went to Bretz before the field. He was an undergraduate. He took the course as an undergraduate, and then he took the graduate version of it. So he took both versions. So he went and said, well, what should I read up about this? And Brett said, absolutely nothing. Absolutely. You go in and you find out for yourself. And so Brett would not, you know, he wouldn't just throw them out there. If they had questions, they could come and talk to him. He wasn't going to tell them the answer, but he was going to sort of, you know, get hints and things like that. But they had to go out and figure it for themselves. And after that, they could, if they wanted extra credit in the course, write a report on the other literature on the events, you know, related to what they had seen.
Since he was often on the receiving end of it, Brett's recognized that the whole experts know best dogma often got between the researcher and the truth. And geology has taken his lesson there on board.
And Hubbard was completely shocked. All these famous people had worked in this area. It's called the Bear River Lake area of Wisconsin. And they were wrong. That they had missed things. And after that, he realized that there is no such thing as an authority in science. Nature is the authority. You have to be humble in regard to what nature presents to you.
As I said, this is a far cry from how archaeology handles its mistakes historically here in the Americas. It does this kind of shit all the time. Before Clovis first, there was another dogma. It was called Folsom first. Same idea. There was the Folsom point. The Folsom people were supposed to have been the first people in the Americas, and anybody that challenged the notion of that risked having their career destroyed. Now, they didn't call them the Folsom Mafia, but it's the same damn thing, all right? And this isn't the first time, and it won't be the last, because for whatever reason, archaeology puts evidence on the back burner when it's arguing about this stuff, and it puts narrative on the front. And a lot of times, they'll step way outside of their wheelhouse when they're doing this. For example, there's a paper called The Comprehensive Refutation of the Younger Dryas Impact Hypothesis, the comet impact I mentioned at the beginning of the video. Now, in this comprehensive refutation, there are some geologists and other people that have pertinent credentials there. So there is a scientific debate. But the vast majority of names on that paper are archaeologists and anthropologists. People that, they know nothing about this, man. They don't study that. They don't look for signs of mega floods. They don't even look for it. So it's not in their wheelhouse. But they're there signing off on it because, man, that whole Atlantis thing, that whole thing gets tied into all this, and so they want to make sure that a Younger Dryas impact hypothesis doesn't get its fair day in the court of scientific opinion. One of the things that they will frequently say is, the science is in. The floods, we know where the floods came from. Glacial Lake Missoula melted over and over, or the ice dam broke over and over again, and it sent all this flood waters through that area over and over again, as many as 100 times. And that's what created the Channel Scablands. Period. End of story. But geologists aren't so quick to say this. In a paper from 2024 titled Okanagan Lobe Tunnel Channels and Subglacial Floods into Moses Coulee, we read the following. Outburst floods from Glacial Lake Missoula largely explain the erosion of the channeled scabland, a system of overfit basaltic channels in Washington, northwestern United States. However, it is challenging to explain Missoula flood routing into Moses Coulee due to its topographic isolation from flood routes. The channeled scablands can't be completely explained by the current model, so geologists accept alternate explanations, even ones that turn back the clock and go back to the subglacial flooding that Brett's posited almost 100 years ago. They don't face this hegemony of freaking ideas. They don't face a bunch of people that have circled their wagons and said that it's the Glacial Lake Missoula Mafia and that nothing else could possibly have contributed to any of the flooding. That's not happening. They know that all of the area is not fully explained, okay? They're still looking into it. It's the debunkers that are going to tell you that it's already done because they don't fucking know, man. They're just looking into this from the point of view of trying to win an argument. Therefore, they're going to be the people that will tell you we can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Atlantis didn't exist and that flood never happened the way that it said, the way that these guys want to say that it did. It's just... So... Those guys are a little bit of a problem, and I dare say wouldn't do so well in the ranks of geologists nowadays. They would probably have a hard time with those guys because they would be like, I don't give a shit, man. But these archaeologists, these debunkers, these guys are in it for ideological purposes, and evidence is going to continue to take a firm back seat. For example, there's so many names on this whole paper that bashes the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and almost every one of those names, not almost everyone, but the vast majority of them are archaeologists and anthropologists, people that are not equipped to weigh in on that thing any more than I am, but they still sign their name to the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis being bullshit. There was no comet that hit the Northern Hemisphere, no way, no why, no how, but the geologists... They might agree that there was probably no comet. I don't know. I haven't asked a bunch of geologists. But what I do know is I don't see their names just littering that paper like the archaeologists and the anthropologists. I see a couple of geologists there. I also don't see them pretending that nothing happened when they made a big mistake. J. Harlan Bretz is almost deified. He's considered one of the best geologists ever. He's won a Penrose Medal. And he said the only thing that was, like, he's got some quote that's kind of funny about how he couldn't gloat to anybody because everybody he wanted to gloat to was already dead because he won it like he was like 90 years old. But compare that to the way that archaeologists treat the Clovis First people, you know, Tom Dillahay and Jacques Cinq-Mars. Both of these guys are barely spoken of, and when they are, it's usually to be like, well, you know, they still had a career after all that. It wasn't that bad for them. People just make a big deal out of that. Not at all like geology, where they're like, man, we fucked up. This guy was amazing. He stood up to our ranks and battled through and pushed truth through, and we need to learn from him and stop putting professional expert opinion between our researchers and the data, because that lens is fucking things up. Archaeology did not learn from that. They still put that lens there, and it still fucks things up today. And the debunkers that come around, the people that are like, oh, yeah, well... You know, the reason that J. Harlan Bretz's flood was not accepted for so long, these guys tend to employ some of the very same kinds of arguments that the Clovis First people did, where it's just kind of, it's almost apologism. They're bending over backwards to basically make excuses as to why the evidence wasn't accepted. Oh, you know, it took like aerial photography before they would accept the channeled scablands. And, well, the channeled scablands being created by a flood, what happened in the late 70s, and was accepted in the late 70s, and the first aerial photography of the region was published by Bretz in the 50s in a book. So that doesn't wash. It was 25 years between the two. 25 years they had this evidence, and they didn't do anything with it. Nobody accepted it. They didn't care. All right, and geology has learned from this. A guy named Thomas Pardee, he was the one who discovered Glacial Lake Missoula, all right? He was the one that figured out it happened. And so they're supposedly in a conference, and Bretz is being grilled by somebody else going, where's the water that created your flood? And according to legend, Pardee's like, I know where the water is. But he didn't say anything at the time. 10 years later, he sends a letter to Bretz. Bretz reads this letter, and he's like, oh, cool. Includes it in passing in his next paper, but it seems like Bretz didn't really give a shit as to where the water came from, even though it would have, like, totally mitigated the amount of skepticism against him. But Pardee was afraid to speak up in the time because Bretz was being drug across the floor, man. Bretz went into depression after one of these times of him just being annihilated by a bunch of his colleagues telling him that he was stupid, he was an idiot, he was full of shit, politely but firmly telling him that he was dumb. And they were the ones that were wrong. Geology knows this, and archaeology hasn't learned from this. And I think that this is something that archaeology really, really needs to pick up on. When you put an expert opinion, when you put that filter of this must be this between your researcher and your evidence, you get Clovis first. You get the same shit over and over and over again. You stagnate your field. Yes, you don't want people just going out and throwing out any old thing they want and calling it science, but you can't lock things down so hard that the only thing that gets through has to be passed basically the opinion of a handful of people, because a lot of times that is all it is an opinion. It's not evidence-based. It's flimsy at best. Now, it's no secret that scientists get emotionally attached to their hypotheses. Bretz was emotionally attached to the Spokane Flood. The people opposing him were emotionally attached to gradualism being more important or being more real than catastrophism. That big of a flood was just not going to be a thing that could ever happen. So, it's interesting to see how, on the one hand, Bretz pushing hard works out okay. But on the other hand, people pushing against him just destroys things. So what geology walked away from with this was to try to remove your personality and your ego from it as much as possible, and to certainly not look up to somebody else for the answer. When you do your research, know your shit, and answer the question your goddamn self. But that's not where archaeology is now. They want you to always be in line with their consensus. And I'm not saying you can't write a paper that breaks out of the mold, but if it breaks too far out of the mold, even if it's a geology paper or a freaking astrophysics paper, you're going to have archaeologists opposing the damn thing. Even they don't know anything about it, but they're going to weigh in on it because it is in their paradigm. It's crashing down their worldview. It really is kind of a messed up thing. You know, like, sporting teams, if you think about it, like sporting teams in towns frequently have like a zeitgeist, right? Like one team will have the best pitching staff and like another team will have the best batting staff, or maybe your high school's in your local town, there's one that's been like the dominant high school at wrestling. It's been that way for like so long, nobody can remember when that started, right? Okay, that kind of zeitgeist, even though they're all sports teams, same thing here. Even though they're both groups of science, geology and archaeology have a very different zeitgeist, it seems, running behind closed doors. Geologists seem to be willing to accept people coming in with kind of an avant-garde hypothesis, and if it stands up, man, they'll entertain the thing. Archaeologists, on the other hand, boy, that hypothesis better not tick any of these boxes, because if it does, you're going to get a freaking immediate response. They're just going to wall up to it, circle their wagons, and not let you through at all. It will take decades and several funerals before you'll even get a chance at being heard by these guys. And, I mean, I don't know how else to put it. That's cancer compared to where geology is. From what I could tell, that's absolute cancer. You've got guys saying that we need to remove expertise from between our researcher and the data on the geology side of things, and in the archaeology side of things, it's all about building a framework and keeping it all within this framework and everybody falling in line together and nobody going outside, nobody arguing with anything. Hell, planting trees on Göbekli Tepe, if the archaeologist there accepts it and the pseudoscientist here and rejects it, trees on Göbekli Tepe, good archaeology. They've gone off the fucking rails, man. It's cancer. But anyway, I bitched about them enough, and I hope that you could see the point that I was making here. The Spokane Flood's an interesting thing. J. Harlan Bretz is worth researching. Again, links down below to Dr. Zenter's stuff. Hey, I'm going to be speaking at the Cosmic Summit next year. That's right. There's a link down there below, too. You can go click on that and get a ticket. And like, say for instance, last year you were like, man, I really want to go to the Cosmic Summit, but you didn't want to go. But you didn't end up going, excuse me. Don't be like the archaeologist, man. Correct your mistake. go this year. I'll be there. You can shake my hand and we can have a beer and we'll throw darts at pictures of archaeologists that we don't like. I don't know. We'll do something fun, but you should come.